Welcome to Keeping Your Together in a Stressed World with Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg. Each week, we explore down and dirty ways to stop awfulizing, catastrophizing, going down the rabbit hole, and moving through all the craziness that is happening right now. We're here to create a community of like-minded people as we give you tips, tricks, and techniques for keeping sane in an unhinged world. And now, here are your hosts, Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg.
Hey, everybody. This is Scott Grossberg, one of your co-hosts for the podcast, Keeping Your Shit Together in a Stressed World. And I'm here with my co-host, Michelle Post. Hey, Michelle.
Hello, Scott. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you all for joining us on this recorded episode.
Coming to you not live, May 22nd.
God, I'm old enough to remember. Is it live or is it Memorex?
Oh, me too.
Yeah, it's not. It's not. It's Zoom. So anything you want to show? We have our one of our favorite guests back. Sylvia is with us for part two today. And we'll start that in a moment or so. But as usual, Michelle, anything you'd like to share today?
Well, you know how sometimes I talk about personal things and sometimes I talk about trends in my clients and lessons that I want to share with other people. In light of today's topic, which we'll touch on the importance of having a self-care plan for self-regulation and, you know, stress management and things like that, I want to tell you about what happened to me when I broke my own stress management self-care plan. I'm going to out myself. And here's my little tip for the day. In 12-step program, we have a thing called HALT, H-A-L-T. Never let yourself, you know, halt. Never get too hungry. That's the H. Too angry. That's the A. Too lonely. That's the L. Or too tired. And that's the T. And so part of my self-care plan is usually to make sure I don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Well, okay, so Michelle is trying a new metabolic thing for health and blah, 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 and eating healthier and had to book way too many clients in a row. So I didn't get my proper snacks in and I'm burning my metabolism and it's going through it. And Michelle got too hungry. Okay, there's nobody that knows me that thinks I will waste away to nothing if I am a little late on dinner. However, I got too hungry, and here's what happened. Without my snack, without my proper pushing my body too hard, I leave my home office to greet my wonderful partner, Brian, who has allowed himself to get too tired from working all night and doing shift work all night. And so he's depleted, and I'm depleted, and we're trying to navigate dinner, taking my car into the maintenance guy, wondering where our home chef delivery people are, where's our delivery people. And I am so dizzy that I can't speak or articulate. And he's like, I'm not understanding you. And I was like, it was supposed to be here at 3:09. He's like, 3:09? Why is something, you know? Anyway, what happened was I got snappy and I tried to explain to him that I was angry. I don't know if you've ever had an experience of anger where you're not mad at the person. You're not mad at anybody that you love. You're just so hungry that you're angry.
Yeah, it's called hangry.
Yeah, hangry. So I got too hangry. And then I hurt his feelings because I snapped at him and it wasn't about him. He didn't deserve anything. So then I had to do my repair work. And we figured out dinner and I was all okay. But I just wanted to say, like, lo and behold, even me who works really hard at keeping my shit out because he knows I do this podcast. We're driving to dinner. And he goes, Michelle, you really need to learn to keep your shit together. I have this podcast
there you
might
go.
Want to listen to.
That's very funny. Just as a quick reminder, and I wrote about this in my book, right? The Most Magical Secret.
Yes.
It's like shit happens.
Yes,
folks,
it does.
Even to the best of us. And this is why if you want to revisit our podcast episode on Ho'oponopono, I love you. I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you, a number of times. And it really works, by the way, not just as a prayer, essentially, and self-work. It really, it makes a big difference when you really fuck up.
Yes.
To look to the other person and say, I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me.
Thank you. And he did such a good job. He's like, it just hurt my feelings. And I just need a minute to get through it. I heard you say, I'm sorry. I just need a minute. And I was like, honey, you're doing such a good job of sharing your feelings. And then I took him out and treated him to sushi. So he's not a flower person, but you know, you can get to him through his tummy. And so I think, I think we made amends.
There you go. Well, we have a big topic, and we started it last week. And yes. I'd love if you guys don't mind to just go ahead and jump in, Michelle, if you want to introduce our guest again.
I do. My friend and colleague Sylvia Sandler is here with us for part two today. And for those of you that have missed part one, please go back and listen to May 15th, episode 166 on some risk assessment and a stress detector tool. But just to reintroduce Sylvia, she earned her bachelor's degree from UCLA and her master's in marriage and family therapy from Phillips Graduate Institute. She's a fully licensed private practice clinician in California and offers virtual appointments for those of you interested in looking for a therapist. Typically, the population of clients that she likes to work with are adults from age 25 to 65 and up, and her specialties include depression, anxiety, grief, loss, bereavement, including suicidal bereavement, people who've experienced the death of someone close to suicide, poor self-esteem, and caregiver burnout. Sylvia is also really passionate about women's mental health and supporting them and their partners, especially with parent-child bonding or parental identity and family dynamics. So particularly for today and last week's session, Sylvia's experience prior to private practice was included working for D.D. Hirsch's Suicide Prevention Center. And while she was there, she provided individual couple family supportive counseling to those affected by suicide. She was also a clinical co-facilitator for survivors after suicide support groups. That's a bereavement counseling group, pretty low fee, available to those of you in the community who've experienced a death by suicide. She's also been a clinical presenter and a trainer in both English and Spanish for the Speakers Bureau, offering both suicide assessment training and crisis management training to healthcare professionals, community organizations, and schools. So we are very lucky and honored to have Sylvia join us again today. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Thank you so much to the both of you.
Yes.
Excited to have you back. I'm going to sit here now. I may poke in with some questions and let the two of you have at it.
So, Sylvia, last session we were talking about the stress detector tool, the Columbia, and if someone notices that they're somewhere on that stressor scale, okay, so they've listened to that podcast, they're somewhere on the stressor scale, or they know someone who is, now what?
Well, everyone needs a self-care plan to re-regulate when they're emotionally upset, right?
Yes.
And when I think of suicide, that's like on the margins of that dysregulation. Mm. When somebody happens to be suicidal, you work with this Barbara Stanley and Gregory Brown safety plan. And it has six areas, domains, where you can try to engage the person that you are with. So like for me, I use that in my clinical practice to try to help the person say, listen, yes, suicide is on the table, but can we put that to the side and explore other ways to try to, you know, increase the time and distance between your desire and urge to act on killing yourself? So those ideas in the Stanley and Brown safety plan apply to all of us, right? Because, so I'd like to talk to you about each one of those six domains of the Stanley safety plan.
Yeah.
And it's something that every one of us can incorporate to write. And I'll tell you when, sometimes the feedback that I would get from people who have had safety plans done for them or done with them, you know, when they were hospitalized, they would talk about it kind of like, yeah, this is more of a cover yourself kind of thing. It wasn't really
mind.
And so I started thinking about that. Well, gosh, if we talked about a safety plan really as a self-care plan to re-regulate when you're upset, then like people are going to have a much more, they're going to be like more skin in the game and wanting to potentially do this. But just like an architect needs plans to build their structure, we need some sort of template to get back to, you know, to that space of calm and where we're not in a, in a high stress situation. So that's what I wanted to talk to you about today. But I also wanted to mention that, you know, if you're not suicidal, then it doesn't make sense to create it as a safety plan. It makes sense to talk about, because like when I was working with people who were bereaved by the loss of someone that they, that did die by suicide, if they didn't have any suicidal thoughts, but they were still super activated by the bereavement and this loss, they needed something to sort of like sink their teeth in and be able to like come back to center and not be led, you know, like this, you know, like the show talks about, down the rabbit hole of that grief. And that, right. So that's when I came to you, Michelle. You created a self-care plan. And so I used that with my, with the persons that were not suicidal, and then the safety plan for the people that were, but both really are
overlapping. Yep.
And that wanted to talk to you guys about today.
Because isn't good self-care good suicide prevention?
Absolutely.
And like, even I, as I talked about today, if I had followed my own self-care plan, it's good for your family. It's good for your friends not to experience your mess ups, right?
Yeah.
That's right. So by any, just out of curiosity, is like proper nutrition on a good safety self-care plan?
Absolutely.
Right? Hangry.
It absolutely. It, because being hangry could be an activator to your stress.
Exactly.
You have to know what activates those feelings. And then once you know the activator or the thing that gets you to that space, like is, it could be thoughts, situations, people, self-statements, right? Yeah. You know, oh, that's what's happening right now. I'm hangry. Oh, okay. So then it gives you an opportunity for you to say, well, what do I want to do with that? Instead of just going into hangry mode.
Yes. Yes. Get food in your body. Don't upset your partner.
And we're all guilty. I mean, you know, that's part of her humanity, and you know how wonderful it is that we have, that's our vulnerability coming out. But rather than our vulnerability, you know, taking over, we use the vulnerability to inform us to decide what to do next.
Okay. Okay. So let's hear them. What are the categories that are on that you think overlap?
Well, first of all, the thing that overlaps for sure is like, what are some of the things that you can do in your physical environment to make it that you can engage in on a daily, month, weekly, monthly, maybe even quarterly or yearly basis that will keep you more calm? And just like there is an element of the safety plan that, you know, asks for your environment, like take note of your environment. What can you do to make it safer? If you know that alcohol is an activator, you know, or something that you go to cope with the distress of life, don't have as much alcohol in the house. You know, if you know that you have access to too much, you know, pills in the house, maybe just have, store as many as you need for the week, but don't have like a Costco per, you know, version of a thousand
prescription of your Norco. Right.
Because all you want to do is you want to make your physical environment on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and yearly basis adaptable for your safety and for your well-being. Okay. So that's one intersects.
Okay.
Then the other thing is like, you know, your social supports, right? So in the Stanley and Brown, for instance, the safety plan, one of the elements that they want you to be able to really engage in is knowing who are those social supports that you can lean on during times of difficulty, right? So it could be external supports, like maybe, you know, AA or Al-Anon, synagogue, church, anything that helps you to engage with people so that your mood can be lifted. Similarly, with a self-care plan, you know, how do you get your social needs met? You know, are you part of any organizations that, you know, speak to your hobbies? Are you part of any organization that speaks to your professional interests? So making sure that you have a self-care plan and that you engage in these activities on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and yearly basis so that you are fed from that realm, from the realm of like external supports, right?
Yeah, who do you connect with to like feel less alone, right? So like Scott has a poker group, right? I'm sure it brings you joy.
it brings me things, yeah. again, that's a great example, right? That camaraderie that we play, we get together because we like each other. Yeah. And we sit around and we bullshit. And yes, there's, you know, we do our poker thing, but somebody brings dinner and somebody brings dessert, and there's that community aspect to it, and we all care about each other.
Yeah, and breaking bread is like a great one. We just went out to lunch with our neighbors for the first time in a while, and we had such a good time. Yeah. And just like, we offered them support, they offered us support. It really felt good to connect.
It's fun. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? It brings the humor to the darkness.
Yeah. And then I assume is our professional social support, where do professionals come in? Because I do have a coach and a therapist that I work with from time to time. Where do they fall in for you, so, Sylvia, on the self-care plan?
In a self-care plan, it's making sure that you get your needs met, maybe from a spiritual perspective, mm-hmm. you know, where your sense of self is being fed by, you know, doing that introspection and reflection. So
yoga.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Church, yes. Synagogue, meditation.
You know, finding meaning in life, you know, and going to resources of that nature that you can adapt again on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and yearly basis, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Even holiday worship, for instance, you know, right. That's really, really key. And looking forward to the moments that give us joy and help us to feel connected. I mean, really the big overarching thing is that the person who's suffering usually likes to turn inward and be in their aloneness, or the world responds to them where like they minimize their aloneness. It's like, things are not that bad, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But the reality is about connecting and having those moments of using the time well and being able to say, I see you, I hear you, tell me more.
Okay.
So another aspect would be too, like, what do you do to, like, what kinds of other activities can you do to, like, using your internal resources, such as like, can you exercise? Can you listen to music that will uplift your mood? Can you engage in journaling, writing, anything that you can do that you yourself are the source of regulation again, like checking mm-hmm. in part of you when you're not in a place of upset, you go into your internal resources. That's part of the safety plan by Stanley and Brown. But these are things that can be populated into the self-care plan too, for so that you know, like, okay, if I go and I write in my journal, if I have a practice, that's going to actually calm me down. Mm-hmm. You know, in narrative therapy, that's really, really important. The idea of taking our thoughts and putting them on paper so that if you're having a hard time going to sleep, they'll be there. You'll be able mm-hmm. to retrieve it in the morning, but mm-hmm. they don't reflect your mind space so that you can give yourself that pause and be able to hopefully go to sleep. And they'll be there in the morning. It's just not a part of you.
I'm a huge proponent of this, by the way. Yes. As someone who's constantly going, I'm a big believer of writing it down and not trying to keep it in your head, because you're constantly then double checking. Am I going to remember it? Am I going to remember it? Am I going to remember it? And then, I mean, we're not going to talk about it today, but this whole concept of narrative therapy and expressive writing is why I came up with this new project that I've got coming out. The unfinished book on people being able to be very introspective and writing things down and getting it out of their own head onto paper in black and white, where it suddenly becomes something that, as Maria Forello called it, it suddenly becomes figure outable as opposed to dark.
Mm-hmm. What I love about it is the highlight of internal supports versus external supports is, let's say you do reach out and no one's available. Okay, well, what can you do yourself that doesn't require another human that helps you re-regulate yourself? So none of your friends are available to talk through it. Can you journal through it? Does gardening help? Does exercise help? Does your spiritual meditation help? Those are all things that you could do yourself that don't require another person to be available to you.
That's right. And then the other thing too, that, the Stanley and Brown safety plan talks about, that can be also very helpful for self-caring, is just engaging in the external world, being able to be out in nature. They say that being out in nature and seeing greenery can be as effective, like taking a walk and being in greenery can be as effective to help manage anxiety and depression. Because what you're doing is you're being really in mindfulness by engaging in the external in that way. And that helps to really change your mood. So sometimes, if your favorite place is to go for a hike or like going to the beach, that can really elevate your mood if you're having a really rough day. So having maybe a practice where you go like on the weekend, where you take even a 30-minute walk, that could be a lot of, that can save you a lot of distress, and you'll get some vitamin D while you're at it. wherever you are.
Go out, folks, and hug a tree.
Yes. Yes. Or plant a tree.
Yeah. So, and then definitely finding out who are the, we talked about the people that you want to reach out to, that you are, you can trust. You want to make sure that it's people that are going to be non-judgmental and safe for you to really open up, your heart to. You're gonna want to be able to have a conversation where they're not going to get emotionally upset by hearing you're upset, because then you're gonna have to start taking care of their feelings, right? So again, it goes back to the idea that somebody that can sit in the darkness and not necessarily want to go into solve it mode or fix it mode or let's like silver lining. It's just somebody who's just saying, I don't even know what to say. I'm just so glad you're telling me. Tell me more. The best thing you can say to someone when they're in pain is like, tell me more.
Yeah. Share more. I'm here. I'm ready to listen. Yeah. And I do talk about, these are the people that might not be just your coffee house friends. They may be the people that, you know you can trust with some more of the heavy stuff. Like maybe they have a lot of lived experience themselves, or maybe they've shown their support in a different way. So that's everything from the professionals to the like people in your life that are just good helpers. They're just kind, compassionate, good listeners. I don't know if you do this, Sylvia, but I try to teach my clients who have periodic either passive suicidal ideation, like I don't want to act on it, but I don't want to live anymore kinds of pain. I don't want to deal with all this pain, all the way to the active of like, I have had thoughts of wanting to die and have thought about how I'm not ready to act. I try to teach them with me or with the people in their life that are on this serious kind of like available level to say, look, I'm not going to do anything to act, if that's really true. I'm not going to do anything to act on this, but I really need to talk about why I don't want to live or why I don't want to deal with all this pain in my life. Because people get scared of admitting these internal feelings because they think somebody else is going to freak out and hospitalize them or call 911 or whatever. But the more you keep those secrets inside, the more pressure you have almost to act on them. You become more isolated. You become more alone. So having a person where I always say that, like, if you can, oh, what is it that I'll use a better person than my words. It's Mr. Rogers. If it's mentionable, it's manageable. If it's mentionable, it's manageable. So if I can mention it to you, we can together manage it. As opposed to if I don't mention it, it becomes very unmanageable.
That's right. Well, the question is, you know, why? What has happened in the family, in the person's life, that they feel that they can't open up? And the truth is maybe those people, just people in their life, have repeatedly not been available to them. Maybe. So in the safety plan, the Stanley and Brown safety plan, there's an area where sometimes people would say, I don't have any external supports, and I don't have any people I could call in the middle of the night or even during the daytime. And I said, okay, well, we don't leave these alone. You can always call 988, the hotline. You could call online. There is always someone that can be on the other end of the phone that will listen. You can call NAMI. So these are all the types of things that I would do so that people would never would say, okay, that's not applicable to me. No, there's always someone and somewhere that you can dial in to get the support that you need for the moment that you need it.
And NAMI is NAMI.org, and it stands for the National, do you remember what it stands for if people are looking it up?
National Alliance for Mental Illness.
Great. Okay. So it's a great resource for any of you out there who maybe aren't suicidal, but you are struggling with stress or anxiety or depression.
Or as I like to say, you've gone dark and twisty.
Dark and twisty. It's the dark and twisty line.
It's from Grey's Anatomy. I won't claim it, but it's we all get it.
So the other thing I did want to mention too is we have to also talk about why the person in front of us is still here and having these conversations with us. Like, even though if they are in such an emotional state where they're so upset and sad and wanting to just end it all, they're still talking to you, or they're still talking, or they're still in front of you in your office, or they're talking to the helper. Mm-hmm. We hold the hope, because otherwise, why are they doing that? Why are they engaging with us? So that lets us know that they're still connected to wanting to try and figure it out and not have death be the way out.
Well, you know, Sylvia, this brings up something you and I chatted about before we went on air last week, and that is, at least I have often heard the comment made in the context of suicide, that sometimes people are doing a cry for help. And I would love if maybe you and Michelle could expand on that. What does that mean, a cry for help, rather than someone, as you've called it, Sylvia, who is chosen to suicide?
Well, the way that I respond, and I actually just had a conversation with an old friend about this. We're like, oh, the way that I look at it, it could be a cry for help. And the thing is, okay, it is a cry for help, but we have to be able to stand up to it and take all the information for what it's worth. It's information, and it's an opportunity for us as the helper or the person receiving the information to do something. Like, people give us all the time information, and what are we, are we just going to discard it just because it doesn't make us feel good? No, just say, gosh, like, it sounds like you're really having a really rough time. Tell me more. Because the truth is that I believe that in 80% of the people that have died by suicide, they had different types of warning signs, right? It's either through they showed us in their behavior, maybe in their statements, maybe in their appearance. Sometimes it comes out in social media posts that they're going to do something. So there's information, and they're putting it out there. And it's an opportunity for us, if we are clued in, to say, gosh, tell me more. This is a departure of what I've known about you. So I'm going to check in, because that's what we do with information in general, right? If like, you know, a child is having a fever, we're not just going to like let the fever just run amok, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't have a fever yesterday. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, take your temperature and treat you with Tylenol. And then if the Tylenol doesn't work, then you go to plan B, mm-hmm.
call the physician. Call the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Right? Everything should be seen as information to be able to just be curious and see what's next. But just mm-hmm. to pretend, oh, they're just crying out for help and like that doesn't really matter. They're just being their
they're just being dramatic.
Yeah, they're being their usual self of just like
she just wants attention.
Yeah.
I know I'm not often judgmental, but I admit it when I am, and I'm aware of it. And one of them is when people say to me, she just wants attention. I can't help but say, well, give it to her. If she wants attention, can you give it to her? If she's crying out for help, can you help her? Like, why would we ignore those things? You know, I just, that's a part I don't quite understand all the time. It's like, give it to them. If you're not capable and you don't have time, find somebody that can. Just don't ignore it. That causes people to feel more and more alone and more helpless and more burdensome. And, you know, yeah.
I can't tell you how many times like a friend of mine will say, you know, my daughter told me that her friend is posting things on her social media account. And she's like in middle school and she's saying these things or she says she wants to die. And my daughter is asking me not to say anything. What do I do? And I say, you know what? You have to explain to your daughter there's a difference between privacy and confidentiality. Like things can be private, but if it has to do with her safety, you know, it would mean much better for the friend to be really, really angry. Yes. that she went to her mom and maybe the mom had a call with the mom of the child affected than to have a dead friend.
I know.
And if to I know it sounds really rough.
It does.
But usually when people get mad, it passes. But once you die,
death doesn't pass.
That's it.
It's kind of a permanent condition. I heard one therapist describe it like this because she had a teenager, you know, which is a little challenging in your practice because you want to keep their privacy and they deserve their privacy. But the teen said, if you tell my parent that I'm suicidal or that I'm doing this or I need this, then I'm going to be angry at you forever. And the therapist's response was, well, good, because if you're angry at me till you're 65, then you're alive till you're 65. And I would rather have you alive and angry than dead. And it was really kind of a cool thing for me as a therapist to say, like, I've had those moments where I'm not going to have you die on me just because you're threatened to be angry at me. I'm going to try to help you because you told me. So there's some part of you doesn't want me to do anything, but some part of you wants me to do something or you wouldn't have said anything to me. Right. That's a kind of a powerful thing to recognize.
Yes.
Yeah. So did we get them all? Did we cover the areas that kind of cross over? And did we miss anything?
Believe it or not, I think that the financial realm is also really important to talk about because what we know is that anything can carry somebody over to a state of crisis. So if somebody's having a financial crisis, that could be an activator, at least, you know, in terms of understanding what are the thoughts, situations, places, and people that can put you in a place of risk. And then for a self-care plan, it's like having certain rituals that allow you to have a financially sound daily life, weekly life, monthly, quarterly, and yearly. What are the things that you need to put in place so that it won't become overwhelming? Your financial intelligence is going to be there for you to help you as opposed to like get overwhelming. So these are things, you know, so understanding that even that can be a stressor. But then if you, you know, self-care, then that's something that you use it to help you as opposed to be a hindrance.
You know, I want to add one thing here, because I do spend quite a bit of time, particularly with my own mastermind group, on talking about this last component that you brought up, both you, Michelle, and you, Sylvia, and that's the financial component. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of folks use the hope strategy when it comes to money. They don't, you know, and Michelle and I have talked about this, it's, you know, the respecting your money and it will respect you. Mm-hmm. And yet a lot of people, and it's not the law of attraction, they just kind of like expect the money to be there or expect that their future will play out and the like. And I am always a big believer that, particularly when it comes to your finances, that you turn it into somewhat of a game, but you pay close attention to it and it will take care of you. Because I'm a big believer that when you talk about the financial realm and the business realm and your purpose in life, despite the fact that Michelle and Sylvia and me, we're all in the hope business, right? Part of what we do is provide hope to people who feel hopeless and overwhelmed. That hope is not a strategy when it comes to your own personal well-being, and that you plan. And as Sylvia said, where do you want to be next week? Where would you like to be 6 months from now? Where would you like to be a year from now? And frankly, at least I have found when it comes to finances, if you'll project out the desired outcome, you can then configure backwards to where and you'll say, this is what I need to do to hit that number. This is what I need to do. And then you can do it in baby steps. No one is asking you to become a multimillionaire in 2 weeks, unless you hit the lottery. But we know that mindset, by the way, also plays into that. The most lottery winners don't have that money after a certain amount of time. They just don't have the coping skills and they lose it all. Mm-hmm. And so we've talked before about Ken Honda out of Japan, who wrote the book Happy Money.
Yes.
And so I'm going to tie this in and seek Michelle, yours and Sylvia's input. I am also a big believer that when it comes to emotional and mental distress, that perhaps we can help save a life today by asking people to revisit how they value their life. And in fact, wouldn't it be wonderful if you sat back and started looking at your life, not by how much money you have in it, not by how many friends you have in it, not by how much accomplishment you've done, but instead by asking yourself, how much happiness do I have? And that we start doing happy more often. Because I just don't know how compatible happy is with suicide.
Right.
So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Question.
Well, I'm the philosopher, so.
You're the philosopher major. You're the philosophy major, yes, in the group. Do you have any thoughts about it, Sylvia? What's coming to mind for you?
Yeah, what comes to mind for me is you can't get to happy. Brené Brown said this. She said that you can't get to happy without looking at shame and guilt and all of the things that keep us away from being happy.
Ah. Oh, I agree 100%. I love Brené Brown and her constructs. Yeah,
big fans. The other thing I was thinking about is with depression, sometimes, or even just sadness and regret and shame, it's so much looking backwards and wanting the past to be different. And yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that wound to ourselves, like to have an inner kind of nurturing dialogue that says, I'm sorry, we went through that too. And we didn't deserve that. And I wish it was different. Or I wish we had decided differently, or we had saved more, or we had invested more. Or, yes, I wish we had bought property back when it was lower, and you know, all those things that we do. It's okay to acknowledge that, but then you need to stop living in that and recognize, if these are my financial goals moving forward, what steps can I take from this moment forward, from May 22nd forward into the future? What is the next step I need to take to keep forward mobility, forward movement going? Does that mean I take a look at if I have a savings account, is there a better savings account with a tiny bit more percentage of return on it? you know, can I save 1% more per month? Like, what's a baby step that gets you going towards your goal instead of spending so much time beating yourself up about what you haven't done already? So that's something that I think about in terms of money, is that is doing happy. Doing happy is looking, making steps and goals towards what you're trying to achieve.
I would like to, we've got about 10 minutes left, touch on a subject that I think you guys touched on.
Okay.
But it's still weighing on me, right?
Okay.
It's weighing
okay.
on me since our first part.
So somebody else is probably having it weigh on them too. Thank you.
And that is, we all hear about intervention, right? And we talked in our last episode about doing a wellness check or calling 988 together. What helpful tips do the two of you have when the person just doesn't want any help? Now, I granted, if it's a child and they're a minor, there's some other things involved. But let's just use a friend. I'm going to make up a hypothetical. You know, someone is expressing, I don't want to live anymore. They're flat out saying that. I do not want to live anymore. Okay, you know, can we call 988 together? Can we, you know, you want me to get a wellness check? Can I call your friend? Can I call your mother? Can I come over? We do all these things we've chatted about, and they don't want the help. Now, any suggestions for those of us who might experience that?
I have people who come to me after the death of someone close who had their loved one say, I don't want that. I won't do that. I won't do that. And there's nothing that we can do in hindsight. So I want any of you listening with past experience around this to take what I'm about to say with no judgment on whatever decision you made in that moment. It was the best decision you could possibly have made in that moment. But for those of you that hear this segment and it happens in the future, this is an ethical dilemma that only you can make. I can't decide it for you. I can't tell you, you know, will this person be safer if you don't act and force them to go inpatient or call 911, or will they not? What I can say is, just like we were talking about the teenager that's going to be mad at me until they're 65, but at least they're alive. That's my method. Is like, I'm very, very committed to trying to get people the help that they deserve. It's hard to find. It's not always perfect. Hospitalization is not always the best answer for some people. I have had clients actually go into the hospital and have complete life-changing positive experiences and really have their suicidality mitigated, proper, regular psychiatric evaluation occurring, medication management occurring, tools taught to them, and a reprieve from their daily life and stress while they're hospitalized, and really kind of fine-tune some of those tools. And so whenever possible, I want to try to have someone have the buy-in to get the help that they want. But I'm very, very committed personally that to take action and call 911 when I have to, whether they want me to or not. Whenever possible, I try to get them to buy into it and try to get them to see that they need a high level of care whenever possible. I'm very, very rarely do I call to try to get intervention against someone's will. But if someone says, I want to die, but I don't want any help, my only thought is, I wish you wouldn't have told me that you want to die and you don't want help, because I'm going to get you help. You know, like that's it. I can't, if you told me you want to die, but you don't want help, why did you tell me? Like, it obviously means to me, unconscious or not, that you want help. Because somebody who really doesn't want help will go off in the woods and tell no one.
Well, and that kind of brings up the last question I have for the two of you. And that is, maybe we can also give the people in our audience who are not suicidal, but may encounter that type of situation with a friend or a loved one, and they don't know, there's no expression ahead of time, right? Do you guys have any coping mechanism techniques or any thoughts you can offer to people that say, God, I should have seen the signs, or I should have done something. And I know the easy answer is call Sylvia and get counseling. But you know, the reality is, are there any techniques for helping people understand that sometimes, while we like to think it's preventable, sometimes this happens and it's not your fault that you didn't prevent it?
Do you want to start, Sylvia, or do you want me? You have thoughts?
Well, one of the things, if I can interject, is that, you know, we have this semblance of thinking that we have so much of life is in our control. And yes, the truth is that we have so little control over anything, really. And so, the, you know, unfortunately, suicide is like the most in the margins expression of somebody's self-determining, right? They have the right to do that. Mm-hmm. Our job or a friend's job is to show up and connect with them as much as you can with the time that you've got, because, you know, I'm really passionate about doing caregiver support to love to families or parents who are loving a loved one that has very serious urges to suicide, or they attempted and survive their attempt. And oftentimes the parent was like, please tell me, how do I save my child from the next time or from even attempting? And that's not the job. Like, you know, I was taught by somebody really, really wonderful. I don't have a bag of beans to give to you. There's so much you can do. You can love your loved one. You can support your loved one. You could listen. You can laugh. You can make memories in the time that you have.
That you have.
Connect, because that's all we can all do anyway, mm-hmm, our daily mm-hmm life.
Yeah. What car accidents, illnesses strike at all times. It's not just suicide, right? Like, we want to connect with people when they're alive.
And I'm going to just say this. I was doing a seminar yesterday, and I have recently started going around the room as a group and asking everybody, how many of you feel overwhelmed in your jobs? How many of you feel burned out? How many? There wasn't a hand that wasn't raised.
Yeah. And any one of those can be an activator for right a risk assessment. But keep going. What happened?
Well, I talked to them about centering and grounding and doing the Buddhist concept of strong back, soft front. And, you know, I can start feeling, particularly when we take a break and someone comes up to me and says, you know, let me ask you a question. and then there's the ability at that point to do some further assessment on my part if needed. And I want to point out, the world has gone a little crazy.
Yes.
It's going to get a little crazier.
Probably.
And what I've called dark and twisty, I'm starting to see it expressed more in people. Not that it's gotten worse. I'm starting to hear people express it.
Okay.
And in fact, as I was listening to you, I think it was 3 weeks ago, not a friend, but yeah, a friend on Facebook. Let's, you know, the difference, right? It's right, just somebody who had either friended me or I don't know what had happened. Right. And so they show up in a feed, and on there, they literally, all they wrote was, I don't want to live anymore.
Oh no. On your Facebook.
Well, it was on their Facebook. It showed up on my feed. Now, a lot of people reached out to this person who were closer to them. I didn't do anything because it's like,
but you saw all the other people.
I saw all the other people showing up, and it's like, I'm starting to see more of that.
Okay. And okay, so this is a classic example. That person was showing signs. How we handle it, we need to figure that out, right? But there are probably always for the rest of our life going to be people that secretly suffer, you know, a life of quiet desperation, tell no one, show no signs, and act quietly without anybody being able to know. And the other thing is, while when we do psychological autopsy, which means we look backward on the person's life and we look at what their signs are, often we see signs that are connected to suicide, but we didn't know.
Right.
We didn't know there was no warning sign. Yeah, we didn't know context. We were trained in it. And one of the things that I had a group member who was a psychiatrist, and someone in his life had died from suicide. So he was in my bereavement support group. And he was so great at encouraging people, because he said, look, even me, who am trained in mental health, I missed the signs with my so-and-so. And so we're not all perfect because we have our own stresses and we get our own self-obsession going on and we have our own bad day at the office and we have our own, you know, bills to pay. And so we can get really self-focused just trying to survive this dark and twisty world. And so you can miss things in other people. And that's human nature. You don't have to take on that responsibility.
Thank you. So Sylvia, it does. we're at the end of the show. A big two-parter. Is there anything you'd like to say at the end here? Because I have a question for you if you don't have anything else to ask or add.
But we don't want to cut you short if there were things that we didn't give you time for.
No, thank you so much for this opportunity. I hope that this has been helpful.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Again, can you remind everybody how to contact you?
The best way would be through my website. It's www.sylviajsandlerlmft.com.
Wonderful. So I've got a question for you. What does Sylvia J. Sandler do to keep your shit together?
I love to reach out to professional and social supports. I love networking, but it's very quality. I keep in touch with people and just continue to feed the relationship in a very genuine and loving way. And I just love people. People are just really wonderful. I learn so much from them and I love to see their heart space and then to be a receiver and a sender back of that.
Okay, well, thank you for being on the show. Michelle, thank you for introducing me to Sylvia.
Yes, absolutely.
I really urge everybody, if you did not check out part one, please do so. So this will be a two-parter, part one and part two. And next week, we're going to take a little different turn. We've been talking about the shadows this time, but next week, we're going to discuss laughter therapy and the science of humor and how it helps relieve stress, so that you're going to get both ends of the spectrum now. And with that, thank you everybody for listening to us. Again, Sylvia, thank you for being a guest for two parts with us. Please like, you know, promote us,
subscribe, share.
All these things you can do on social, on your podcast platform now. And again, thank you to the ever-growing Spotify family of friends. With that, thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've reached the end of another episode of Keeping Your Together in a Stressed World with Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg. If you like our show, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate our broadcast, and leave a review. The podcast is for general information only and not intended to be legal or mental health advice, nor the formation of a lawyer-client, nor therapist-patient relationship. Stay tuned for our next episode, and thank you for listening.